superparticles, supersymmetric particles in the Higgs would be light, and that Lepp would discover them below, many of them below the Z mass. And of course, now we know that this is not true. LHC, the first run of the LHC, has pushed many of the superparticles, particularly the colored ones, above the TeV scale. And now even the electroquinos are pushed in the hundreds of GeV region. So the connection, so they are moving away from the Z mass. So the connection of supersymmetry with the hierarchy problem is diminished. And this is not only true for supersymmetry. It's also true for all models that try to address the hierarchy problem. So it's fair to say that our field finds itself at the crossroad. On the right, you have the straight and narrow path of naturalness that leads to, that says that in order to explain the smallness of the Higgs mass and the weak scale compared to the Planck scale, you need new theories, new degrees of freedom close to the weak scale, and theories like supersymmetry, large extra dimensions, technicolor. And on the left, the more adventurous direction that emerges is the idea of the multiverse, the idea that certain parameters in nature are not set by dynamics, but by environmental selection. For example, the Earth and sun distance is a parameter that's environmentally selected. Out of the many solar systems that are in the universe, we just happen to find ourselves in the one where Earth is close enough to the sun so that it's warm, but not too close so that it's very hot. Yeah, so one, so now the question is, what does the multiverse lead to? So the more boring aspect would be just that this just leads to the standard model. So there's no new physics all the way to the Planck scale. But there could be, as I will argue, there could be more interesting more interesting theories, still tuned, but could give rise to light degrees of freedom that the LHC could discover. And these are the theories of split supersymmetry.
Are there any places that it does not lead?
Are there any places? Yeah, places where we're not here. So I'll come back to your question. The question is, the landscape can give you anything, so why you not even bother? So I'll come back to the end about that.
What about the Higgs mass hierarchy?
That's the point, that in these models, the Higgs mass hierarchy, the theories are truly tuned. You have parameters that scan, that make sure, for example, you have two large, in order to explain the hierarchy, let's say you have two large parameters of order of M Planck squared, and they have to cancel to precision of 32 decimals. If you have a scanning mechanism, this can happen. I'll come back to that later, okay? A scanning mechanism could be, as I told you, for planets. Most of the planets in our universe are not equipped to handle life. They can be very close to their star, so they get too hot. Their density is not right, so they're gas planets, so you cannot even stand on them. Or they're very far and they're very cold. So actually, when right now there is what they call, even astrophysicists that look for planets, for exoplanets, they have what they call the Goldilocks region, which is a region that has the right distance from the star that they look at, where the planet has the right temperature. It's not too cold, nor too hot, and they believe can accommodate life. So this is what happens with the Earth. We have 10 to the 22 solar systems. We don't have to solve dynamically why the Earth sun distance is what it is. It's a historical coincidence. We just find ourselves where life can grow. So let me continue. So I'll start by reviewing the status of low energy supersymmetry. And then I will focus on split supersymmetry. And I'll discuss that particular models, model building split supersymmetry, as well as the phenomenology of those ideas. And the question that I will try to address at the end is, what could we learn from the Higgs? So the first question is, why supersymmetry? And the answer is gauge coupling unification. In the early 90s, at LEP, they've measured the gauge couplings, and they've found that if you add superpartners of the standard model particles at the TV scale, they will unify, they will all meet at a point at a scale that's roughly 10 to the 16 GeV. If you take the same values and you run with the standard model couplings, with the standard model particle content, then they do not unify. And they miss by a lot. And how much? Well, you have to multiply the two-loop contribution of the running by a factor of almost 10 in order to make this work. So that means you need huge threshold corrections in the standard model to make it unify. So it makes it quite unlikely. Now, let's imagine that you reverse the question. Let's imagine that back at LEP, they would measure the gauge couplings, they would find that it agrees with the standard model prediction. I think by now, given that LHC has found no superparticles, no one would be talking about SUSY as much as they are. So if the situation were reversed, supersymmetry would be in a really lot of trouble, even back then. Another input that we have, experimental input we have in terms of low energy supersymmetry is the Higgs mass, which is at 125 GeV. And as you all know, with a minimal supersymmetric particle content, you require that the Higgs mass is below the Z mass. So you need to fix this, and the way you fix this, you either do it with radiative corrections by making the super partners heavy. That automatically makes your theory tuned to at best at the 1%. But there are an easy way out. You can add new physics. For example, you can add one singlet to the MSSM, and you have the NMSSM that increases the Higgs quartic, and as a result, increases the three-level Higgs mass. Another way you can do that is by adding a new Yuan prime, new gauge interactions close to the TV scale. So the Higgs mass, I don't think it's a problem for supersymmetry, but the main problem now for supersymmetry comes from the LHC. And the fact that we haven't found any superpartners yet. So this is a plot that summarizes the Squark and Gluino bounds from the LHC. And this is this hasn't been updated with the late data. This is for almost 6 inverse Pinto bounds at 8 TeV. I can use the hockey stick. So this is the axis that shows the Squark mass versus the Gluino mass. This whole area has been excluded, and as you can see, the middle point is way above the TeV. It's 1.5 TeV for both the Squarks and the Gluino. Of course, this is a very simplistic picture. First of all, it assumes that the neutralino has zero mass, so you have tons of missing energy. And it also assumes that all quarks are universal. So all particle masses, all first, second, and third quarks particles are light. And this is actually quite a bit of an assumption because first and second family quarks are the ones that are copiously produced at the LHC. And the reason is, of course, is because of the proton that consists mainly of first and to a far lesser degree to second family quarks. So there are two main production mechanisms. There is associated production of a squark with a gluino, and a first family squark and a gluino, or two first family squarks. And as you can see from this plot here that shows cross-section as a function of the mass, the associated production, as well as the pair production of two squarks, are the dominant production mechanism of color particles at the LHC, and by many orders of magnitude. So this gives us a way out for supersymmetry. So now, first of all, naively, if you look at the hierarchy problem, we know that the particles want to be light. But if you look at the LHC bounds, particles want to be heavy. But if you look more closely, you see that it is the third family particles that affect the hierarchy problem, while the more severe bounds come from the first family squarks. So if you make the first families' quarks heavy, then you can relax the bounds on supersymmetry and keep this, the stops light. So these are what they call, people call the natural supersymmetry or split family theories. And first of all, I want to say it was first proposed back in 95 in order to explain the flavor constraints on supersymmetry back then that were already pretty severe. So in these theories, in split family theories, what do you keep light? You keep light the bare minimum that you need to keep, make supersymmetry natural. So you keep light the Higgsinos, which have to be, in order to have less than 10% tuning, have to be lighter than 250 GeV. At one loop, the stop center, so you have to make them lighter than 600 GeV. And at two loops, the gluino enters, which is, there has to be light at 1.4 GeV, a TV. So, of course, the experimentalists are well aware of this, so they started, they've been placing more and more stringent bounds on split families that have been getting essentially worse and worse. So now the stops are constrained to be roughly heavier than 700 GeV. As you can see from the from this plot, that summarizes the bounds on the stop mass as a function of the neutralino mass. And the gluinos have to be lighter than 1.3 GeV of a TeV. As you can see from this plot here, a similar plot, lighter supersymmetric particle mass versus the gluino mass. The different shaded regions are different searches. As you can see, the gluino is the one particle that has the most severe constraints on its mass. And first of all, it turns out that it's the most important particle for naturalists. First of all, because it's copiously produced at the LHC, it has the largest color charge. And it also has, and it's also very important for naturalists because of its contributions to RG running. So even though the gluino enters at the stop, at the Higgs mass contribution at two loops, it has a huge, again, because of its huge color charge, it's a big attractor of the RG. And this is shown on this plot. So if you have, so this is a plot that shows the ratio of the gluino to the stop mass, the stop to the Higgs mass, and the, essentially the gluino to the Higgs mass as a function of the running scale. So this is the log of the cutoff over this particle mass. So as you can see, either from after roughly one decade of running, the stop can only be separated by the gluino by only a factor of two. And after three decades of running, which is nothing but what you get in ordinary models of perturbative cage mediation, you can see that even the Higgs mass cannot be separated from the gluino mass by a factor of three, more than a factor of three. Already the gluino bounds are the ones that severely constrain low energy supersymmetry scenarios. Another bound comes from electroweakino bounds. LHC has already placed severe constraints on electroweakinos. And if you look at channels, this is two different searches. This is a search that looks for associated chargino and neutralino production that both decay later to the LSP as a function of the LSP mass. And you can see roughly that the bounds on electroweakinos are around 350 GeV. This is another search that goes where the electroweakinos decay through a stop. Again, is that around the bounds that are around 50 GeV, namely. That means now that the Higgsino has to be heavier than 50 GeV. So this is a three-level tuning that's introduced in the theory. Of course, now if you make the electroweakino, the light of the LSP, heavier than roughly 100 GeV in both searches, you relax the bounds. But there's already a lot of tension, so you have to start hiding in corners. And this is a plot that summarizes the situation, what I've tried to explain to you before, the situation in fine tuning in natural theories, given the current bounds of the LHC. This is a plot that shows the stop mass as a function of that shows gluino mass versus stop mass. The contours are contours of constant tuning. And so the yellow region is what's already been excluded by direct stop searches. The let me leave this here. The gluino, The green region is what's excluded by direct Luino searches. I've placed the mass of the mu term, the Higgsinos, at 120 GeV, so they are put in a little, and the LSP is 100 GeV. As you can see, first of all, in this plot, I have ignored, yes?
I can't read
in the boxes, but what are the labels for that? So here is 25% tuning, 10% tuning, 5% tuning, 1%, 0.3%, and 0.1%. So already from the bounds, you can see that the 10% tuning is already excluded. And this is quite an optimistic scenario, first of all, because I have assumed that you do not require any radiative corrections to give the tree level, the Higgs mass. All the Higgs mass comes at tree level. I also assume that the cutoff of the theory, the messenger scale, is very low. It's 10 TeV. So once you start increasing the tuning, that will also get worse. At the same time, if you try to make, let's say you compress the spectrum, let's try to make the LSP heavier, won't help, because in that case you'll make automatically the Higgsino heavier, so you introduce more tuning. So it looks like split family theories are getting really cornered, and but I still think there is room, and a spectrum that could work is the following. So let's assume now that you have the first and second family particles heavier than 3 TeV. The gluino is right at where the current band is, at 1.3 TeV. Stops and bottoms at around 600, 700 GeV. The mu term is at below 200 GeV. You have a Bino NLSP, and the gravitino is the true LSP of a lattice supersymmetric particle. So first of all, in this spectrum, you need to add at least one singlet to raise the Higgs mass. You also need to break Giugino universality in order to have large hierarchy between the gluino and the bino. You also need to have to lower as much as possible the gauge mediation, the mediation scale, so that you minimize the effects of the gluino running. So you can have a large hierarchy between the gluino and the stop mass. And at the same time, of course, you have already broken scalar universality to separate the stop mass from the squarks. So that means that, well, and of course, the spectrum seems to be tuned to less than 5% level, but it starts looking a lot like you're doing too much to do what is supposed to be a very simple task. Even though I think the window for split families and natural supersymmetry is narrowing, there is still some room, depending on how your taste in terms of fine tuning are. But I think the final word in terms of natural supersymmetry will be given by the LHC14, where the expected reach of the gluino mass would be at least 3 TeV. And in that case, then this whole parameter space that I've shown you will be wiped out. And we can probe tunings more, the theories that are tuned to more than 1% level.
Sorry,
yes?
Detailed question, but
yeah.
Why do you want to have a bino LSP?
It doesn't. A Bino LSP rather than the Higgs.
Yeah, Bino and LSP. It seems like.
Yes, because if you. Yeah, yeah.
LSP.
So, yes.
Yeah.
So, if you do that, turns out that if you look at the bounds on the Higgsino, there is a search that looks for Higgsino going to gravitino, and that's the bound is 350 GeV.
I see.
So.
But at the limits on gamma plus X.
So for such low masses of Bino, you can assume if you make the Suzy breaking scale enough, the Bino will decay outside the detector. So you have to be careful.
Even with your running starting at 10
TV. Oh, no, I haven't assumed running of 10 TV. So in order to have that spectrum, the running has to be from 10 to the 6 GeV.
Okay.
So it has to be 1,000 TV. Fine. So the tuning that I keep showing is actually quite an optimistic tuning.
Okay.
The moment you do anything reasonable, the tuning becomes less than 5% already.
Okay.
So now...
What does reasonable mean?
Reasonable means, for example, 100 TeV. The Messenger scale, so you require... The point is that in order to have perturbative gauge mediation, you require roughly a loop factor hierarchy between the messengers and the standard, the MSSM particles. So that means roughly a factor of 1,000 because the couplings are electroweak. So that means 100 TeV or 1,000 TeV for the cutoff. That would be the more reasonable. You can imagine that you have some generalized gate or direct mediation scenario where the cutoff is really low, 10 TeV. And there's such scenario, I mean, I don't, they don't look great, but still a possibility.
What happens to the neutral Higgs at 125? Because depending on how it's fine tuned with the mass.
No, so that's the point. So for that neutral Higgs, I assume there is an additional source that of quartic. So there is an additional source that there's an additional new physics that contributes to the Higgs quartic, and that raises the three level Higgs mass. For example, that can happen in the NMSSN. So if you write a coupling that's of the form S H up H down squared times lambda, this introduces this lambda. You have a correction that's of order lambda squared in the quartic, and that correction can be enough to raise the Higgs mass at three levels, so that you don't need radiative corrections to raise the mass.
Calculate the radio correction supersymmetry.
Yeah.
The Higgs mass.
Yes.
It's logarithmic. It's proportional to the difference between the superparticle.
Yeah. These are very small. Yeah. This is a three level effect. So this is a three level effect. This appears at three levels. So it's a larger contribution. So I don't rely on the contribution coming from this log hierarchy. That's why the stock can be at 600. If you were to raise the Higgs mass just by the radiative corrections coming from the stop has to be right now in the multi-TV region. So in order to have 600 JeV stops, you need an additional source to the Higgs quartic at three level to raise the mass. Something like this.
It seems rather unreasonable. That's a magic.
What do you mean unreasonable? These models, anyway, we can discuss this later, but NMSSM is not that unreasonable because you need a solution to the mu term. So... so I think it's quite reasonable. It's one more ingredient. Do you like it? Do you not? It's not that bad. So I think now it's time to switch gears and talk about the multiverse and the theories of split supersymmetry. So in split supersymmetry now, the scale of Susie breaking is completely disconnected from the hierarchy problem. So the scalar superpartners can be much heavier than 10 TeV. In principle, anywhere from 10 TeV all the way up to the gut scale. Fermion superpartners, on the other hand, can be protected by symmetries, by R symmetries. So they can remain light, lighter than roughly 3 TeV. And as a result, this manages to preserve the success of gauge coupling unification that's already in low energy supersymmetry.
So we're already in the multiverse, so why are we talking about supersymmetry, a split supersymmetry?
Because of gauge coupling unification. If you take the gauge coupling unification seriously, then it tells you that there are light scale.
So we are already in the multiverse, why we care about this gauge coupling unification?
Because experimental fact. You don't care about experimental facts?
Experimental doesn't tell us anything about the gate coupling unification.
Why doesn't it tell us anything?
Well, it tells us that the three lines meet under certain assumptions.
Yes.
Yeah. And maybe that's just a coincidence.
But it's maybe evidence of greater dynamics. It's indirect evidence. You can choose to completely ignore it if you can. But the fact that you add some particles that are otherwise didn't have any reason, they were motivated by initially by the hierarchy problem. Here in split supersymmetry, they're motivated by some symmetries that can preserve.
There are a lot of models which can have this gate coupling.
No, there are not a lot of models that they can models that are accommodate. There is one model that predicted gauge coupling unification, that's supersymmetry. I have to say, by the way, the first when they first proposed supersymmetry in the 80s, people were making fun of them because back then sin squared theta w was agreeing with the standard model value with huge error bars, but it was still with agreeing with the standard model value. Right now, the standard model value is like 9 sigma away from what it's supposed to be.
But even in the, if I remember correctly, even in the non-supersymmetric version of isotope model, people can still have this baby unification.
Yeah. No, they can.
They can.
First of all,
they can add all this. They have a lot of particles. They can put it in any scales they want.
You can have huge threshold corrections. There is no reason, if you, the more representations you have, the more particles you add, the more funny it gets to have three lines meet. I can tell you the following example, okay? So imagine you have, I mean, we can discuss this more detail, but it's good to say this. So you know the S&T parameters, right? The electroweak fit. You remember the ellipses that were there, the 1, 2 sigma. So the central value, the best fit, was a fit with a light Higgs at 125. People with models that were predicting heavy Higgs were pushed away out of the ellipse. And they were saying, oh, you can have new particles that push you up and bring you back into the ellipse. Of course, experiment didn't choose to do it this way. The experiment actually agreed with indirect evidence. I tell you that the 125 GeV Higgs was the best Higgs, and this is where we found it. It's the same with unification, I think. You have to have, not only, you need to have huge threshold corrections, that all the particles have the right hierarchy so that, boom, they make the couplings unify. And the other problem is that in the standard model, the unification scale is actually 10 to the 14 GeV. It's lower than the supersymmetric unification scale. That's actually excluded by proton decay searches. So if you look at proton decay searches, they tell you that the gauge coupling unification scale has to be heavier than 10 to the 16 GeV. So not only you have to add the threshold corrections at 10 to the 14 at the right scale in order to make the couplings unify, they have to make the couplings run enough so that they push the unification scale at 10 to the 16 GeV. So it looks a lot like you have to do a lot of mechanics to make that work.
I mean, 10 to the 16 is still a bit dicey for proton decay, depending on how you do it.
Yeah, but I can show you. I have numbers, so it's still. I have a plot, but I'm not showing it. I can show you later. We have a plot that we checked it. So it's still, you cannot push. So for proton decay, you cannot push the superparticles, even in split, much above the 100 TeV, because that lowers the unification scale. But it's still okay.
Yeah. Down to 13 TeV, 3 years. If you keep pushing the bones in supersymmetry, it comes to the, those three coming together.
Oh, it's still okay. So I'll show you a plot later that answers that question. So hold on to that thought. I'll show you.
One more comment, please.
Yeah.
It's unification. The inverse coupling is called logarithmic. So it's an enormous extrapolation.
Of course it's an enormous extrapolation. And I'm not saying, yes, but you have to admit that the fact that you take two lines meeting is obviously not a coincidence, right? But three lines meeting at the same point, and actually a point that points to a higher symmetry, doesn't seem so much as an accident. You can argue, well, people say the argument of Earth and the Moon, they match in size. That's truly an accident because there is no symmetry region. But unification actually points to dynamics because it points to an enhanced gauge group. It tells you that all the couplings unify to the same value and to a point that's of enhanced symmetry. So it's more significant than an accident. Of course, for the reasons you say, you can only take it as indirect, as evidence. You cannot, it's not proof that supersymmetry is there. I mean, experiment will be, but I take it as a good guideline to assume that supersymmetry is still there and keep looking for it, even in this version, a split SUSY version. And okay, after this big parenthesis, so, and in split supersymmetry, you tune, there is a large tuning to get the Higgs to be light. And that's required in order to have atoms, to be able to have atoms in our unit. So you change the weak VEV by a factor of a few, you end up not having atoms or complex chemistry. So as I've already told you, unification split supersymmetry works very well as long as the gauge genus are light. And it works just as well as in ordinary supersymmetry. And this is a plot that shows the inverse coupling strength as a function of the log of the energy scale. And you can see again that they unify roughly at the end of the 16 jobs. In these theories, there is also a prediction for the Higgs mass. So if at the Susi breaking scale, which is set by this particle mass, but the scalar particle mass, you impose Susi boundary conditions for the Higgs quartic, and then you can run down at low energies. That gives you a value for the Higgs mass, and which is represented in this plot here as a function of the breaking scale. This band here is a band because of the different values of tangent beta. Tangent beta equals 1 is here, tangent beta of equal 50 is there. So like you can see now that the measure value of roughly 125 tells you that the scalar particles in split supersymmetry cannot be heavier than 10 to the 5 TeV. So that's why we'll call this version split supersymmetry mini split from now on. And it also tells you that because of the factor between the factor of hierarchies at most 10 to the 5 between the Gegenos and the scalars, this implies that you have one or two loop separations between the scalars and the Gegenos. So now let's combine these two and see what we learn. So this is a plot that shows the in the parameter space of the Gegeno and Higgsino mass. Here I'm varying the Gegenos along with the Higgsinos, and the scalar mass, the parameter space that's allowed for the Higgs mass. So for different values of tangent beta, this yellow region. The bands, the green bands here, are bands because of the error on the top mass measurement. So this is the parameter space that's implied by the 125 GeV Higgs. And actually, these lines here are the 1 and 2 sigma contours for unification. And by sigma here, I mean I have taken to mean the two-loop contribution in the running of the gauge couplings, which is the measure of the amount of threshold corrections you can have. So now you can see that already, in order to have good gauge coupling unification, you need the mu term, the Gegenos, to be lighter than roughly 100 TeV. So already unification tells you, in order to have good unification split supersymmetry, tells you that the Gegenos are lighter than 100 TeV. And at the same time, as long as tangent beta is not very small, you can see that if tangent beta is larger than 40, already also the scalars have to be lighter than 100 TeV. So you also have to be careful that at the same time you also satisfy flavor bounds. Now going to more details about mini-split model building. In mini-split theories, just because electroweak symmetry breaking is tuned doesn't mean it always happens. You have to make sure that the Higgs mass, the determinant of the Higgs mass matrix, is almost zero. And this puts severe constraints on the parameters of the theory. So we can distinguish two different cases. One, when MH up squared is less than zero. In that case, in order to make these entries both positive, otherwise you get a huge negative determinant, the Higgsinos have to be of order the scalar masses. So the Higgsinos have to be heavy. The other case is when MH up square is positive. In that case, you have to make B mu large in order to make a zero determinant. And there, in that case, the Higgsinos have to be light. So as I will argue now, in most models of mini-split, this is the case you will encounter. You will see that the MH up square wants to become negative. And the reason is Argyrani. So if you look at the masses of the stop and the uptight Higgs, you will see that Besides the usual Yagina contribution, there is also a large contribution coming from the large Topiu gamma. In ordinary supersymmetry, this huge Yagina contribution protects the scalars from becoming tachyonic. But in split supersymmetry, that contribution is not there because the Yaginas are light. So now, either one of these three masses can run tachyonic. And if you look at this equation, you can see that there is an IR fixed point where this quantity, which I will call XT, the sum of these masses has to be zero at the IR. So that means either the uptype Higgs or the stops, either one of the stops, has to run tachyonic at low energies. Also, if you look more closely, there is also a UV fixed point that fixes the ratio between the left type stop, the right type stop, and the up type Higgs to have the ratio of 1:3. So the closer you start to this UV fixed point, the longer it takes to run to the IR fixed point. So the longer it takes to get tachyons, and you can actually delay the appearance of tachyons if you are close to this 1:3 ratio. So to summarize, if you look now, if you want to build models of mini-split, first of all, you have to avoid having tachyonic stops, so that you don't break color. First of all, you have to make sure you successfully break electroweak symmetry breaking, even if you have to tune. You have to make sure your scalars are between 10 and 10 to the 5 TeV in order to get the right Higgs mass, and while the Higgsinos are lighter than 100 TeV in order to get gauge coupling unification. At the same time, you also have to still have to satisfy flavor bounds, because those naive bounds are at 1,000 TeV for the particles. So, yeah?
Did you discuss the Higgsinos lighter than 100 TeV for unification?
Say that again?
Did you talk about Higgsinos lighter than 100 TeV?
Yeah.
I went
back because there is this plot. I can go back here. So if you look at this plot, so this green region is what is in this parameter scalar versus Yagino masses. If you look at this plot, this is the region. The yellow thing is what is favored by the Higgs mass, and what's left of these lines is what is favored for gauge coupling unification.
Oh, where is the Higgsino mass?
The Higgsino mass is here, because I'm varying the Higgsino mass along with the Yagino masses. This M1 half is
the. Oh, so you fix the Yagino mass. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, it's the general with the Higgs with the Yaginos.
I appreciate it. Okay.
Yeah.
But you couldn't push off the Higgsino mass.
It doesn't. So the Yagino contribution, as long as they are close in mass, they don't have large hierarchies between the Wino and the Gluino, is not important. So the most important here, I could have just mu term here. This would give roughly the same answer.
Okay, so I should think about more strongly the. Okay.
Yeah, you should think about this more strongly depends on the Higgsino than anything else. The Yaginos are not that important for the Wino and the Gluino are not that important for unification unless you start separating by many orders of magnitude. Okay. So given these constraints, so the question is what should we expect at the LHC for split supersymmetry? So the smoking gun for split supersymmetry is long-lived gluinos. Gluinos in split supersymmetry decay to two jets, to the LSP, usually the Bino, through a very heavy squark. This is, so they give rise to two jets and missing energy. The lifetime is set by a dimension 6 operator. And it's roughly, it's of order of centimeters for a gluino of mass at TeV and a Suzy breaking scale of 10 to the 4 TeV. So now, and this is a plot that more summarizes this, the decay of the chronology of the decay of the gluino as a function of the gluino mass and the Suzy breaking scale. And so for Suzy breaking scales roughly lighter than 10 to the 3 TeV, the gluino will decay promptly at the LHC. You won't even see the displaced vertex. If the Suzy breaking scale is roughly lighter than 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 TeV, the gluino will decay through displaced decays, roughly of a size between a millimeter and 10 meters. So it will still decay inside your detector. But if the Suzy Braking scaling is heavier than 10 to the 5 TeV, it will decay outside the detector. And it turns out that if you look, the mass that's favored, the range, the Suzy Braking scale that's favored by the Higgs mass, you find that most of the time the gluino will either decay by giving rise to displaced or prompt decays. So long, collider-stable gluinos are greatly disfavored right now by the measured Higgs mass. Split supersymmetry has been quite popular with experimentalists. So they have looked for collider-stable gluinos. And for also they've looked, without their knowledge, of course, for prompt or slightly displaced gluinos. And for those searches, actually the ordinary split family searches, ordinary direct gluino production searches apply. Because at the LHC, they cannot tag on displaced gluinos. They cannot tag on displaced jets. So in this, you can see the bound is roughly the same as before, is 1.3 TeV. And there's also a search that looks for long-lived particles, for particles that hadronize and then punch through the entire detector. And they leave small amounts of energy going through the calorimeter, or they appear as heavy muons in the muon chamber. And the bound from those searches is roughly, again, 1.3 TeV. The great thing about the LHC is that with the 14 TeV machine, they may be able to see gluinos up to 3 TeV. Now, besides the gluino, in split supersymmetry, you can also have light electroweakinos and Higgsinos. So the phenomenology of these particles depends on whether or not the Higgsinos are light or heavy. So if the Higgsinos are light, you have large mix in the electroweakino sector, and you can measure another type of unification, what I will call Yukawa coupling unification. If the Higgsinos are heavy, you can see other types of signatures, such as displaced gluinos, or if just the Higgsinos are light, then, which is what is called the minimal model for dark matter unification, you may be able to see, or you may be producing displaced Higgsinos at the LHC. If the Higgsinos are light, you will be producing neutralinos or charginos, and they will cascade to the lightest particle through the Higgs, the Z, or the W. And already the searches that they have in place for electroweakinos in ordinary supersymmetry place a bound on these particles of roughly 350 GeV. The expected reach for LHC14 with 300 inverse femtobands of data is this dotted line here, showing this plot as a function of the lighter supersymmetric particle mass and the chargino neutralino mass, second heaviest neutralino mass. And you can see it can go up to 800 GeV. This red line is for, the solid line is actually for discovery, and the red lines are for a high luminosity version of the LHC at 3000 GeV. This, I should say here, that these are searches that look for neutralinos going through decaying, cascading down through a W and the Z. But the moment the mu turn becomes a bit heavy, turns out that the dominant decay of neutralinos to one another will be through the Higgs. And this is a search that they have not done yet. I hear that they will be doing something by the end of September. There's Andy Haas in New York that's doing such an analysis with Kyle Kramer. So actually, we expect these bounds to be slightly relaxed. So now, I want to be optimistic and so the question is, what will happen if we discover all the electroweakinos? So in split supersymmetry, in ordinary supersymmetry, the couplings between the electroweakinos are determined solely by supersymmetric relations. So they are set by the gauge couplings. In split supersymmetry, because a Suzy breaking happens at a high scale, these are turned into Yukawas that run at low energies, and they deviate from their ordinary supersymmetric value. So if you were to measure the couplings between the Higgsino, the Wino, and the Bino, you would see that initially, and you would plot their difference with respect to their SUSY value as a function of the energy, you would see that they would unify at the SUSY breaking scale, at the mass of the scalars. And this will also tell you, this is actually an indirect verification of the fact that these particles are supersymmetric in origin, that you have a that these come from breaking supersymmetry. And at the same time, it's also a cross-check, because once you measure the gluino lifetime, it also gives you a handle of the SUSY breaking scale. Yes, you have the question? No.
So I just scratched
it. Okay. Now, if the Higgsinos are heavy, there is no more mixing between the electroweakinos. And if you look at the Wino state, the charged and the neutral Wino are only split by electroweak corrections. And this mass splitting can be anywhere between 155 and 175 MeV. So in this case, the heaviest of the two, which is the charged Wino, will be decaying to the lighter Wino through a soft pion. And that will result in soft pion emission energy. The size of the tracks are order of a few centimeters. And they've already been looked for in the context of anomaly mediated model. So there are already some bounds in the mass splitting versus mass parameter space. The way they look for these is they tag on the initial state radiation, very energetic jets coming from initial state radiation. And then they look for charge stubs, for finite sized charge tracks in the tracker. And this is the bounds that they get. There should be an updated analysis again for this coming this summer. A similar thing happens actually when you have a light Higgsino, only the Higgsino is light. Again here, and the Wino and the Bino are heavy. Again here, in this case, again, the charged Higgsino is the heaviest particle, but now the mass splitting is larger, 355 MeV. So the soft pions are there are still produced soft pions, but the charge tracks are far shorter. They are of order less than a centimeter. So they're much harder to look for. And in fact, I don't know of any search strategy that is able to look for this type of signature. So there are actually no LHC bounds for this scenario right now. To summarize, so if you have, mini split is the way to go, the current measurement of the Higgs mass and gauge coupling unification tells you that, first of all, you should expect the gluinos produced at the LHC to give rise to displaced or prone decays. You may be able to measure, probably at the ILC, what's called Yukawa, another type of unification, Yukawa coupling unification, that will tell you the supersymmetric origin of these particles. And also, depending on the spectrum of electroweakinos, you may see funny signatures at the LHC coming from displaced decays of Winos or Higgsinos. So I'm coming close to the end. So the question is, what will the Higgs tell us? First of all, in a natural theory, if you have dynamics causing the quadratic divergence coming from the top to the Higgs mass, you should expect the same dynamics to affect the production and decay of the Higgs at the LHC. The production and decay of the Higgs at the LHC is through gluon fusion, which is the loop process, and the main decay of the 125 GeV Higgs is to the main decay, most important decay channel is through a loop of charged particles and then decays to two photons. So if you have any, the more natural the theory is, the more these processes are affected by new particles running the loop. So you should not expect that the Higgs that you discover at the LHC, it's natural to have anything to do in properties with the standard model Higgs. Vice versa, the more standard model-like the Higgs is, the more tuned the theory becomes. And this is what it looks like right now. This is a plot taken from a recent theory paper by Alessandro Strumia that shows the best fit in the fermion coupling versus the best fit to the vector coupling of the Higgs. And you can see it matches very well the standard model prediction, actually within 20%. So in fact, right now, we should not expect more than 20% deviations in the Higgs properties. And this is actually what is expected from if you have light stops in the theory, because the given bounds on the stops, so you can stop centers again in the gluon fusion loop, and you can enhance or suppress the Higgs production cross section depending whether or not you have large mix in the stop sector. So current bounds on the stop allow for only 10% deviations. The coupling, another thing that can affect the Higgs decay is light charginos, for example, the WINO. And in this case, again, current bounds on the charginos tell you that you cannot have more than 20% deviations in the Higgs couplings. So instead of summarizing, I would like to contemplate what would happen if the LHC were to discover light, slightly displaced gluinos. First of all, by measuring the gluino lifetime, we can measure the Susie breaking scale. So we can build a higher energy collider to produce the superparticles. Of course, if we can, if the scale is 1,000 TeV, it gets harder and harder in a lifetime. The other thing, we can build the ILC, and if the electroquinos are accessible, we can measure Yukawa coupling unification. But I think the most important thing that we learn is that the standard model is tuned, the electroweak scale is tuned. In fact, though, there is another tuning in the theory that's much bigger. The measured value of the cosmological constant is 120 orders of magnitude smaller than what we would naively expect it from the theory. And given with a single universe, unless you have dynamics, it appears as a miracle that the value of the cosmological constant is so small that it allows for galaxies to grow. If you allow, of course, for more universes where the cosmological constant is scant, then the question of the smallness of the CC becomes a question of environmental selection. Similar to the way the Earth-Sun distance has such a value so that the Earth doesn't get burned or is not a frozen planet, we find ourselves in the universes that have the right value for the cosmological constant to allow for galaxies to grow. Such a theory, the question is what creates the universe, these universes, and these universes naturally arise in string theory. So in string theory, you have extra dimensions that are necessary for the mathematical consistency of the theory, and you can they have to be quantified in order to give rise to a four-dimensional world, and you can imagine that every point in our universe has a small blob of extra dimensions. And this compactification can be quite simple. They can be compactified in a sphere, in a torus, or a slightly more complex, or something like this, which is six-dimensional Calabi-Yau. And the more complex, the compactification, the more universes you have. And depending on the shape of the extra dimension, the laws of nature change as well. It turns out that the same complexity that gives rise to a plenitude of universes can give rise to a plenitude of particles. These particles can be spin 1, gauge bosons, or they can be spin 0, pseudoscalars, they can be axions. And the mass of these axions can change anywhere, it depends exponentially on parameters, so it can be as small as the Hubble scale, 10 to minus 33 eV, or as large as 10 to the minus 10 eV, which is the kilometer is the QCD axiom scale. So depending on their mass, they can have different signatures. So if these axions are between 10 to the minus 33 and 10 to the minus 28 eV, they rotate the rotation of the CMB polarization that could be detectable by Planck. If they're heavier than 10 to the minus 28 eV, they start becoming a significant component of dark matter, So they can suppress scale at a structure at small scales, and they can give rise to signature experiments like Bose of the 21 centimeter line. Now, axions that are heavier than roughly 10 to the minus 20 eV, and between 10 to the minus 20 and 10 to the minus 10 eV, they roughly match the size of astrophysical black holes, and then can cause their spin down through the effect, what is called black hole superradiance. This effect will affect the mass and spin distribution of four black holes that you measure in the universe, and they can also give rise to monochromatic gravitational waves that are detected in advanced LIGO. And I could actually talk about more about this on Thursday. So to conclude, I think that the LHC will hold a lot of information about one of the most important questions currently in our universe, whether or not there is a landscape, whether or not there are dynamics that set the weak scale is set by dynamics or not. And these measurements at the LHC could be correlated to what you see in other experiments. So thank you. Yes?
Supposing I chose to interpret the coupling unification as tuning, how much of a tuning would that be?
As a tuning? For which one? For the...
So supposing, how accurately do I have to tune things?
For the standard model, it unifies to 10%, let's call it.
So that would be like 10% tuning.
Yeah. In supersymmetry, for example, is good to 1%, which is quite amazing.
The experimental precision is 10%.
Oh, no. The experimental precision is not 10%. The experimental precision, these are theoretical errors. So you need to change the values of the, you need to add threshold corrections at the high scale that change the values of the coupling at the level of 10%. The experimental precision that we've measured sine squared theta W and alpha S, the strong coupling, is much higher than that. Is per mil level.
So if you don't work with supersymmetric case, then in the standard model case, the answer for the precision which I have to adjust the.
I have another plot I can show you. Let me see if I can find. So if you were to plot, let me do this. So the way you get the supersymmetric, the prediction for unification. So you start by running the two couplings, the electroweak couplings, alpha 1 and alpha 2. You see where they unify, and then you get a prediction for alpha S, for the strong coupling. So usually what they do is you have a plot of essentially sine squared theta W and alpha S, okay, the strong coupling when you do. So now, so if you take theoretical predictions, meaning that you add some amount of threshold corrections. What people usually do is they take as a size of the threshold corrections, the amount of two loop running, you get a band that looks like this. For the standard model and supersymmetry.
Which threshold are you talking about now?
So if you have some, for example, if you have any representation that breaks that does symmetry breaking at high scale, will have threshold corrections, meaning you have
I understand why you need them in supersymmetry.
Yeah.
I'm asking the question about standard model, how much I have to adjust the coupling.
Yeah, so this is what I'm trying to show you. So if you have a plot like this for the standard model, this prediction is for the standard model in this band, the experimental is somewhere here.
So how
this is like, I mean, if you, it's actually more than that. It's like 9 sigma away, so it's not even in this plot.
So that was a 10% number?
No, it's not. I don't know how much tuning you would call it, but it's 9 times this amount of splitting between the experimental value of sine squared theta W and alpha S. There is this distance is like 10 of this.
I mean, I guess the spirit of my question is that I don't think people who rely on the multiverse are sufficiently and have bought into it with sufficient strength, I think, because I think
for unification.
Well, for anything, because I think once you really, it's very liberating to be in the multiverse, right? So.
No, but there are things, yes, but the question is what are determined by tuning, what is determined by dynamics? For
right.
example, so for the, for example, gauge coupling unification is by no means an anthropic quantity, because the sine squared theta w is not a physical quantity. You can have any value of sine squared theta w, and you have exactly the same physics.
So the
argument for why this is an evidence for dynamics, meaning that you and not some accident, is because the argument, the usual argument for typicality. So if this value appears natural, there will be vastly much more universes that have gauge coupling unification come from dynamics instead of universes where it appears like an accident.
Right.
For the Higgs, it's not the same.
I hear you. I understand the argument.
Yeah.
But I think it's also true that if you just look at the models, there's enormous overlay of theory to get that one point. So it's not clear. The real problem is that it's not clear what the rules are, right? And so what is it that we're allowed to use anthropic arguments for, and what, how do we quantify?
Yeah, this is what I'm trying to tell you. So it looks like in our universe, for example.
Yeah.
So it's the usual argument that people use typicality. For example, the universes where if sine squared theta w is not a physical parameter.
Yeah.
So if gauge coupling unification is there, it looks like it doesn't have anything to do with our existence. So it looks like it comes from dynamics.
Well, so you say, but the thing is, reasonable people would doubt that, right? And so that's
no, no, of course. That's why I'm taking it as indirect evidence for new physics. The thing is that it's not a guarantee that you go to the LHC and you measure superparticles. But I think it's compelling evidence because of the fact that you have three lines that had no reason to meet and they meet.
But I'm old enough that I've heard the same people say the same compelling evidence for nationalist arguments 10 to 15 years ago. And so I know these things are moving targets, and I think probably the strongest argument against the anthropic line of argument is that it's really not clear what the rules are and how we should use them.
No, okay, so the question is, okay, but then the question is, what happens, yes, but, no, anthropic reason. So you say, what do you do about it? This is the question that you should be struggling with. It's not giving up. First of all, if there are quantities that seem to be tuned, for example, take one example. Exactly. So that one, I think it's compelling algorithms for the landscape. And the only reason that it's compelling algorithms for the landscape is because the landscape gives you a way to scan the cosmological constant. The same way, the fact that if we were, imagine the following. Imagine that our solar system was surrounded by a cloud and we could not see the other solar systems. We would do the same thing people back in the 1600s were doing. We would try to explain dynamically why the trajectories of the planets appear to be the values that they are, why the Earth is where it is.
No, I've heard this argument, and it's semi-compelling. I think that, you know, even in the cosmological constant case, which is the best case,
yes,
you could even there argue that you know, Weinberg does the best job possible,
yeah,
where he scans the one variable, but he doesn't scan the size of the parameter,
yes,
fluctuation.
But then the thing is, experiment. Do you have dynamics? Is there any dynamics that explains the cosmological constant?
So part of the question is deciding what's dynamical and what's kind of an environmental question. And even given that,
yeah,
there's another problem as to how you assess the probabilities of, you know, what.
No, the probabilities, I agree with you. The probabilities, there's no way of assessing the probabilities, okay? Because I don't think of any reasonable way, because you need to know how the landscape looks at the high scales, blah, blah, blah. So I don't think, but the right way to know what's dynamics and what's not is experiment. If the CC were determined by dynamics, you better then find some light degrees of freedom. You better then some modification of gravity. You better find some light fifth force, something that close to the CC scale that explains it. So it's not just that it's tuned to say, oh, it's tuned. The fact that we have not seen a single evidence of experiment that tells us that there is new physics at any scale that's associated with the CC is more compelling evidence to say that it's tuned. And I think the same thing is happening now with the LHC. There is still some room for half natural theories. Maybe there's a 5% accident and theories is still natural, but things cancel 5, 10%. Okay, things happen, but we better find 9 degrees of freedom at the LHC, at LHC 14.
I think the argument that naturalist people should be worried about naturalists, because, you know, the hierarchy problem, we were expecting things to be there.
Yeah.
And kind of things. I agree with that completely. But I think that it's kind of a slippery slope once you...
I know you disagree.
and I understand the arguments that are there against it. But I think it's really... if it was so compelling and so easy to understand how to use that framework, people would use it.
Yeah, but that's why I talked about the axioms. For example, when you embed this multiverse picture in string theory, you need this complexity, you need fluxes, you need compactification, you need a large, very complex compactification. The moment you do that, automatically, Kaluza-Klein decomposition tells you you have light degrees of freedom. It tells you to have axioms, tells
well,
you have...
That's not model, that's again not model dependent, right? That's the thing.
No. It's true, but the point is that the same picture... So now, let's talk about... I mean, I understand where you're going, but it's going to be evidence, because, first of all, you agree with me that even people that work on string theory have to address the fact that the theory they're working on could be Planckian physics. So then the question is, how do they know that the theory they're working on is correct? You cannot have experiments. So you only work with evidence, right? So... we have one evidence that the CC is tuned. Unless someone comes with it, if someone comes up with a dynamical solution, great. But given the experimental status, it's not only theoretical problems; it's also experiment. So we know that the CC is tuned. We may be finding out that the weak scale is tuned. There is another parameter in the theory that seems to be tuned, that's associated with no new physics at a scale where you should expect it to be. And then, let's say you go to an experiment like LIGO, or you go to Planck, you find an axiom or two, or more. Then this starts fitting together in the string, in the landscape that's emerging from string theory. I agree with you. Now, we were discussing during lunch. For example, imagine now that you have evidence for a bubble collision, CMB. That's further evidence for internal inflation in the landscape. It's not going to be, the point is that it's not going to be one thing. The point is that it seems there are going to be several things, several indirect evidence that all seem to fit under the same picture.
We should be
and
smart.
This is okay, and this is what you should be looking for.
Right.
You agree? I'm not giving up. I don't personally give up, and I think that we should be looking for experimental signatures for exactly the reasons that you say. And I think it's good to be skeptical, but I don't think it's fair to just criticize and dismiss it. Because no one dismisses string theory, but string theory gave rise to this landscape. So...
I think the string theory is the best string theory.
Well, actually, I didn't want to interrupt, but you could have said that a few weeks ago, but I would assert you cannot say that anymore.
What?
You can't say that string theory predicts a landscape anymore.
What?
Basically because you need... So all the compactifications that we know of, and particularly, basically, you know, it's inevitable once you assume the supersymmetric compactification, you have lots of modules, you have lots of massless, you know, fields. Now, if these get lifted in any way that we know of, you end up adding positive energy contribution, fluxes, range, whatever, and so if we're not going to have a, you know, equivalent scale cosmological constant in our dimensions, which we clearly don't, have the KK scale cosmological constant, we need a compensating source of negative energy. And the only source of negative energy which we know how to use, orientipoles and all these things, we now know what is unstable. That is, you can get basically arbitrarily negative energy contributions once you do that. So it's not kosher.
Yeah,
I'm not aware of
it.
I don't know. I haven't heard this.
Keith Kopsey, it's on the thing, and I'm happy to explain it.
Okay. I
don't
have to hear it.
That's
right.
So can I?
Yeah.
Are there possible correlations between, say, the electroweak scale, which we're saying we're requiring for anthropic reasons to take certain values?
Yeah.
It's a parameter that does, involve the selection factor.
Yeah.
And parameters which are completely unrelated to these selection rules.
Like
I think, as you were mentioning before, the real compelling cases come from correlations. So if you have something that's heavily selected that correlates strongly with another variable, then you might assume that this other variable, well, it can take any value, so draw it from uniform probability distribution, and then combine that with your selection factor, and then you have a prediction for what's next.
Yes.
Are there such parameters that are correlated? You might hope to make progress in some toy model, granted the rules are totally ill-defined.
There are, for example,
but...
there's a paper. It's very hard, though, because the moment you start making assumptions about probability distributions, you're so sensitive to what you call measuring the landscape. Whatever your landscape is, it depends a lot on how you populate it. So there are several people that have tried to make, for example, I don't know if that's what you have in mind. There's a paper by Wilczek and Riese Degmark, where they actually were trying to get bounds on the amount of dark matter you can have. If you have two species, for example, if you have an electroweak kino and if you have an axion at the same time, what is the value of the dark matter that you prefer? There's another paper by Brent Feivogel that does the same thing for the QCD axion. And in fact, if you put a certain type of measure, you find that even the phase that are large are 10 to the 16, there's no tuning absolutely, and the axion does not overflow. So there are things you can do. I don't know how robust they are. In a sense, as I said, I think experiment is a better guideline. The moment you cross the TeV scale, if we, let's say we go to 100 TeV, and we still have not found any new particles that explain the lightness of the Higgs, that's evidence for tuning. That's very strong evidence for tuning. For the CC, it was the same. It's not just that, oh, the landscape tells you to scan the CC. We haven't found anything that, any experimental evidence that there's a dynamical scale, a dynamical degree of freedom, that, or modification of gravity, that's associated with the scale of the CC. And that's the more push. It's experimental evidence that tells us that the theory is tuned. The other options that are effective with theory understanding is totally erroneous, but I mean, it works so well for so many things, so that doesn't seem to be the case.
But I mean, we do, as Cliff mentioned, learn a lot when you consider scanning other parameters. So, for example, when you let the amplitude of primordial density fluctuations.
No, of course.
Then the prediction totally changes. So
the
question is, you know, are there similar correlations where now if I throw some other variables in the
yes.
mix,
so
you
for
can
example,
tell me
there is,
about
there
how
is,
this
yeah.
Change.
So there's a paper, if you're interested in that, there's a paper by Ronnie Harnick, which is called The Weakless Universe, where they take the weak scale and they take the W mass and they make it go to infinity, so they turn off all radiation, but they keep the part of the cover so the particles remain light. So there they end up getting a funnel somehow. They end up actually getting stars that burn helium instead of hydrogen, and then they kind of get something that resembles our universe in some sense. So even there is some, if you allow yourself to vary enough parameters, there could be funnels in this parameter space where you change what your prediction for the weak scale is or for the CC is. Or, again, for me, the strong evidence is, other than these predictions that give you some guidelines or where you should expect the parameters to lie, then the other experiment is just experiment. The fact that there's no dynamic solving that problem.
Well, I'll push back on that and say, if you want to go on the left road, we should try and understand, we should take this picture seriously, which means you need to contend with these things.
No, you need to think about them, but you should not dismiss them. And people should, I mean, what you're doing is fair. You're thinking about bubble collisions. You've worked on it a lot. There are other things that are, there are other things. There's the axions. People need to think about this experimentally and not just dismiss it. Because if this is a possibility, we have to deal with it, and we have to deal with it as physicists. We have to find
signals. If people dismiss it, I think it actually probably gets more press than it needs to get, right? It's, if anything, it's probably overlooked that rather than dismissed.
No, I don't know, somehow. I mean, we can have this discussion now. Am I still being recorded?
Yeah, okay.
You can turn it off.
Take your microphone.
Off the record.